Ellie Harrell, you are an artist, correct?
Yes, that's a label that has been applied to what I do in this world. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I have these notes to what to talk about with you, and it occurs to me we could spend hours here talking about things that you have done. But let's just start out with, here you are in Frankfort, Michigan, but where are you originally from?
Well, I was born in Pleasantville, New York, home of the Reader's Digest.
Mm-hmm.
But at a young age, around 8 years old, we moved to Marietta, Georgia. And that's the Atlanta area, was home for many years with some jaunts in various places, but mostly in the Atlanta area. And it was from Atlanta that we moved to Frankfort, Michigan in 2008. Having never been to Michigan, but once or twice before, we have no history here, but just felt really drawn to the area. And for the most part, because at the time I was a landscape painter and I just fell in love with the look of the place. And I just saw the dunes, I saw the water. And I said, I could paint here for the rest of my life.
Did you come here to visit the place before you moved?
Just a couple of times. I had a friend who was working in Traverse City. Growing up in Atlanta, my only sense of Michigan came from the only thing I would have thought about was Detroit. And Detroit, I'm not an urban lover. And so I really wasn't interested in Michigan at all. I had no idea, this best kept secret up here in northern Michigan. I had no idea. It was a secret to me. So after years of calling my friend in Traverse City, complaining about the Atlanta heat, the traffic, the bad air. And she would, every year she'd say, well, you should come to Michigan. And I'd go, I just didn't register because it was like Detroit. Why would I go to Michigan? And so one year just to visit her, not to come to northern Michigan, my husband, Rue, and I came up here. We flew up and it was the middle of August and we got off the plane and it was a little chilly. And I was like, oh, this is nice. Sleeping with a blanket in the middle of August, if you come from, life in Atlanta, Georgia, is pretty attractive. So I visited my friend. And then the next year we came back and we'd had a big flood in our house in Georgia. It seemed like all the signs were saying, leave this place. We came to visit my friend and she brought me out to Frankfort. And went to the beach, and I changed in that bathroom that is existing in the parking lot on the beach, and it was just perfectly adequate to my purposes. Anyway, changed into my bathing suit and got in the water, and I was like, oh, this is heaven. It's heaven. I got out my phone, or it was my camera at the time, and just started snapping pictures of for sale signs. And we were looking for kind of the next place. We've been taking care of my mom. We were looking for the next place to move. And, when my husband arrived, I said, I think this is the place.
And here you are.
And here we are. Came back a few weeks later, a couple of months later on a painting trip and was staying in a little cottage on 4th Street. It was at the time called the Artful Lodger, which I thought was appropriate. And the house next door to us went on the market. And the timing was just so precise that it just felt like one of those meant to be kinds of opportunities. And without even seeing the house, because my husband was back in Atlanta, we made an offer and were the proud owners of the property on the corner of 4th and Forest, which is now my studio and gallery.
Yeah, it's... It's a beautiful house. And boy, you have. I was over at your house last summer as you were having, I don't know what the term is, a show, because you had a lot of people over there.
The annual art party.
Yes. And I happened to go down in your basement. You have a museum of your work down in your basement.
Well, all over the house. And then the basement is storage for larger paintings that I really don't have the wall space to display. But yes, I have been very prolific here in Frankfort and just have enjoyed such success that I never dreamed possible, and probably wouldn't have, you know, if I'd stayed in Atlanta, where I was just a small, you know, little drop in the big ocean down there. Up here, you know, my work attracted a lot more attention.
Now, you came to art, painting, not early, but later in your life, did you not?
Yes, I was actually 52 years old when I received a calling, kind of out of the discontent of my life at the moment. I became aware that, I literally was at a meeting in Boston of a group of people called the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. And my history at that time, this was in 2002, was at the moment when the Boston Globe had uncovered the clergy abuse scandal. Basically, it went, the movie Spotlight kind of describes this situation. And I came to recognize that I was one of the children who had been molested by a priest when I was for a year when I was 10 years old in Marietta, Georgia. So when you see Spotlight at the end, they scroll through the names of the towns where they became aware of a priest or priests who had been exposed in their activities. And I went public with my story once I realized that this had occurred to me, because it's very, you know, in that kind of a situation, it's easy to just bury what happened. But suddenly, having seen a story on 60 Minutes, I felt compelled to write an article for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. So I wrote an op-ed article about what had happened to me. And very quickly, I was contacted by the religion editor of the Atlanta paper. And kind of without really knowing what was going to happen, I became a public spokesperson for this situation. And I was on the local television. I was in the paper. Actually, it went national at one point. With the National Catholic Reporter. But what happened was I was on television and my phone started ringing, and I'd pick up the phone and I'd hear, well, I was listening to my messages at that point, but I'd hear somebody say, a woman's voice saying, oh, that must have taken a lot of courage to do what you did. I saw you on the news last night. That must have taken a lot of courage. And at the time, I didn't really think of it as being courageous. It was just a moment of truth, and I just followed, you know, my conscience to that TV interview and the newspaper interviews. Anyway, the voice would say, I'd hear this voice saying, you know, it must have taken a lot of courage. And then the voice would change into that of a child. And I'd hear the voice say, I think it might have happened to me too. So it turned out that as a result of the publicity that I had received, in the beginning, 12 different women who had been my classmates in the fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, in the school where this situation had occurred, they all contacted me. And we began to meet. Now, I should say that I was at that time transitioning out of I'm an ordained Unity minister, and I had pioneered a church in Atlanta in 1990. I'd started a church in downtown Atlanta. But after 10 years, I was ready to not be doing church anymore. And I kind of had this kind of, you know, love-hate relationship, because my spirituality is, you know, probably one of the most important things to me. And it really, you know, comes through in my art today. But at the time, the only form I knew to give my spiritual yearning, longing, was in the church structure. But obviously, because of my history, I had kind of conflicted feelings about that. Anyway, I, at this time, I was free and able to open my home and begin to start meeting with these women who contacted me. And at the same time, kind of, you know, many kind of wonderful synchronicities, coincidences happened. And this woman who saw me on television, who wasn't one of the abuse victims, she was working in an office that my husband had rented, you know, kind of a shared office situation. Well, she saw it, her friend said, kind of nudged her and said, you should tell Rue about, you know, that you used to teach at that school. Well, it turns out she said, she contacted my husband. She saw him and she said, well, tell your wife that I used to be a nun and I taught at St. Joseph's School. Well, now this was like less than a mile from my house. And she said, please let her know that she can come and talk to me. Well, it turned out that this was Sister Mary Claire, who was my fourth grade teacher. And Sister Mary Claire became an advocate along with me to help these women and myself resolve and really put to rest this situation. And so for the next year and a half, I involved myself with, not only going public with my story, but seeking some accountability from the hierarchy in the Catholic Church in the Atlanta area. And this proved to be a very interesting, everything that you see in Spotlight, the movie, is true. I can just say I met some of the people who were involved. And this is all a long story and backstory to how I became an artist. Because after a year and a half of dealing with these people, you know, just as an example of how difficult it was, I called up the archdiocese, the bishop's office, and I said, you know, I'd like to speak with somebody. I'd like to tell my story, say what happened. And they responded by saying, well, what makes you think we should, why should we believe you? And I said, well, you should believe me because I'm telling you, you know, that this happened. And there are a lot of other people this has happened to. And I would like to tell you exactly what did happen. So they said they would meet with me, but they would only meet with me if I came with a lawyer. So, you know, it was so, you know, difficult, let's just say, difficult to now have to, you know, engage an attorney, the expense of that, but underneath it, that sense of not being seen or heard by people who at the time, you know, by a system that should have been more interested. And obviously this was at the very beginning and there has been a lot over the last, you know, 20 years or more, there's been a lot more accountability that was actually forced upon the church because there had been so little before. But ultimately, although, you know, there are cases still being reported, but they've had to respond to what happened to many, many, you know, hundreds of thousands of children. So I became involved, and I know I'm talking a lot, but this is a, I guess I'm on the air. You know, as a result, I became involved with a national group called the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. And I went to Dallas. I went to the bishop's meeting in Dallas. I traveled around. I had written a book, actually, just before the story broke. I had written a book about my experience of founding a church, of leading a church. And I really had just delved into, you know, what is it about organized religion that's so problematic? You know, there's a lot of good intention, and then there's a lot of abuse of power that happens within religious structures of all kind. It's not just the Catholic Church. It's you know, in my view, a lot of organized religion has distorted the primary interest of humans to recognize their largest, their deepest, and most essential self. You know, that at the core of it all is there's something really, really good. But of course, people get involved in organizations tend towards power and that distorts good intentions. Anyway, I got involved with this group that seemed to be helpful to the people who were identifying themselves as victims. But I myself was not happy with that label. You know, I didn't feel like this had happened to me as a child in order for me to just suffer my whole life because something bad had happened to me. And I was very committed, and it was part of my spiritual quest, which was to really understand what my choices were in this situation, you know, and that, you know, was there a creative way to kind of go into and through this event that would leave me stronger and better and more capable of being a human in the world today as a survivor. Yes. Well, I even think as a thriver.
Yeah.
I go beyond that to thriving, you know, that, you know, I had also, you know, so I struggled with this label of survivor. I had had, when I went to seminary, I had been diagnosed at a very young age, at 33, with a rare form of cancer in my mouth. And I felt so much as I kind of explored what was this experience? Because people talk about, you know, people who have cancer as being victims. And I understood that, but I also understood that it could be different. And I wanted it to be different, that I wasn't willing to just sort of settle for victimhood in my life. You know, so I've had a lot of experiences where I've had the opportunity to transform that notion of victimhood into something more powerful. And so the art kind of came out of that, you know, the desire to find the fullest self-expression possible. So when I got involved with this Survivors Network, I found a lot of people who were so identified, you know, because perhaps their abuse had been a lot more severe than mine. I mean, some of the stories were horrific, particularly about what happened to the men and the collusion. I mean, just if you want to get into conspiracy theories, you know, there's some just horrid tales that I heard. And it was like, it's such a dark time. You know, it was like nobody seemed, you know, one or two people, you know, finally this one priest, as I was walking out the door early on, having gone public with my story, this one priest reached out to me and he called as I was going out the door to go do a Holy Thursday foot washing service at a local church, not my own. I was out of my own church at that time. But the phone rang and he said, oh, he said, is this Pastor Harold? And I said, well, you know, call me Ellie. I said, I don't go by that Reverend Pastor thing. And he said, well, Ellie, I'm calling to tell you that I believe you. He said, I've seen the file of the priest who was the perpetrator in this abuse. And he said, I've found evidence that your mother and other parents confronted the church and tried to have this priest removed. And they were told, and he understood, that they were told in a letter that it would be better for the church if they would simply let it go. So there was evidence now, and this priest happened to be the head of the Marist order, which in the Catholic Church is, like, you know, kind of divided up into different kinds of hierarchies. But he was like the chief guy in the U.S. at that time for this order of priests. So what he said had a lot of, he had standing in the issue. And he worked with us and with Sister Mary Claire, the former Sister Mary Claire. And we worked with these women and ultimately brought together the women, their mothers, because, you know, this had something, had devastated families, because all these women, we all kept it a secret. You know, we didn't want anyone to know. We thought we were alone. But we created a ceremony of hope and healing in which we, you know, we were able to make statements of forgiveness, of release. And we were also, because I had negotiated this long and hard, recipients of a small, very small settlement, financial settlement. You know, we were looking at the people in Boston getting, you know, millions of dollars, and we got, each person got $25,000. And we had to sign a statement saying that we would not pursue litigation. And we couldn't, because the statute of limitations in Georgia didn't allow for us to prosecute. But there were so many, you know, different aspects of it that I won't go into. But it was, for me, a dark time and a very challenging time, but one in which I felt, you know, just obliged by something, you know, my own history, but also, you know, being part of a larger historical moment of speaking truth to power. It was the first time I ever heard that phrase. But to kind of advance the story towards my art career, I went to Boston for a meeting of this survivors network of those abused by priests. And while I was there, I was just like, oh, I don't want to hear victim stories anymore. You know, this is too, it's not serving me any longer to do this. And I was staying at my sister's apartment by myself. She was gone. And for 3 nights, I couldn't sleep. I mean, just absolutely did not sleep a wink for 3 nights. And during the day, I'd go out to these meetings. And at night, I would just lie there. And this little voice, this still small voice said, do art. Do art. Do art. And, you know, I was like, what? You know, and I had earlier in my life, you know, my father actually was a commercial artist, and he drew airplanes. Well, he was on Madison Avenue as an illustrator back in the 50s. If you saw the show Mad Men, he was one of those creative guys. But then because he had a drinking problem, and that wasn't really conducive to family life, we moved to Georgia so he could work for Lockheed Aircraft. And so he was there working, drawing airplanes. Someone's calling in. but I had tried to do art, you know, at when I was little, you know, draw a picture, show it to my father, and he was very critical. You know, he said, well, you know, your perspective's all wrong. Or, you know, he had very technical comments to make about my art. So it kind of thwarted my impulse at that time. And at various times, I'd kind of go closer to it. But at this point, I had absolutely no interest in doing art. I was writing, you know, and I enjoyed writing, but I was totally intimidated and thwarted in any idea about painting or drawing, anything like that. So when I get this message, do art, you know, I was like, what? You know, I have no clue what kind of art, you know. But I knew that it was a calling. I could feel, because it was similar to this weird feeling of when I got called to be a minister, because I hated church and I didn't believe in God. And yet I had this really strong calling to be a minister. And it turned out really, really well. So I pay attention to that little voice. And I paid attention then. And I came back to Atlanta, kind of washed my hands of, yeah, was working on the ceremony of hope and healing. But I kind of said, I don't need to do this survivor's thing anymore. You know, I don't need, that's done. Although, you know, it wasn't completely done. But I got art equipment. I'd taken an oil painting class like 20 years before, and I dropped it after 3 weeks. But I remembered the supplies list. So I went to the local art supply place, and I bought an easel, and I bought some paint, and I bought some canvas. And I just sat there, and some brushes, and I just sat there and looked at it. Put it in the corner of a room for about 6 months. And every once in a while, I just look at it and go, well, I don't know, what am I supposed to do with it? But I remember, do art, do art. And one day I was, some friends were over and I just happened to look outside the window and I saw some flowers. And I said, I'm going to paint those. And I just went out and plucked the flowers, put them in a little pot, and I made my first painting, which if you come today, I still have that painting. It was a large painting and I had absolutely no idea what I was doing with the paint. But I made my first painting and I was interested in the process and I was curious about what would happen if I kept doing it. And here we are now, 22, 23 years later. Yeah.
I have one question to get, just to sort of wrap up what you've been talking about. And that is, you talked about, you obviously were going to a Catholic school when you were young.
Yes.
And you grew up in a Catholic family.
Well, my mother was Catholic. My father was not Catholic. My mother said, she said, yes, you were a diaphragm baby. She said the diaphragm was in the dresser drawer. And she would go in and out of the church based on how many children she, you know, how pregnant she was. And so she ended up with five kids over a 20-year span. And we all, you know, kind of the spacing had to do with whether her family had convinced her that she needed to go back to the church. But yes, I was raised Catholic by my mother and, you know, was very devoted. At one point I wanted to be a saint and a martyr, mm-hmm. you know, so I kind of had that feeling of sacrificing my life. So when you have a priest who's willing to kind of step into that situation and take advantage of it, you know, that's what happened.
So when this all happened and you confronted it and you worked through it, did you come to the conclusion that it was the individual or the institution?
Well, I actually met the priest. Before I went public with the story, 10 years before, I had been, I'd gotten a lot of therapy. So I was fortunate in that a lot of the women who I met had, you know, really kept it a secret. I kind of knew I was screwed up because of it. And I could tell because my relationships were so dysfunctional. So I got therapy starting when I was 19 years old. I sought it out and, you know, probably have had 25 or 30 years of therapy over my lifetime. But as part of my healing, I wanted to find this guy. And I learned kind of by accident when I heard that he had said mass at the church where I grew up, around the corner from our house in the neighborhood. It was a neighborhood school. And I went to the parish and I spoke to the parish priest, the one in charge, and I said, you should never let this man ever say mass at your church. I said, he has victims. I know that my friends, I mean, at that time I had a sense that there were others who may have been affected. And I said, you know, sitting there in that congregation may be people that this man molested. And it was at that time I got the first hint of the cover-up, because this guy said, well, can't you just forgive him? I said, he told me, he said, he's living at the monastery, this monastery in Conyers, Georgia, outside of Atlanta. And he said, he's living a life of penance. And I said, okay, great. I said, now you've told me where he lives. So I took that information and I called the monastery and I spoke to the abbot and I said, I need to tell you that I was sexually abused by one of the priests who's now a monk in your monastery. And he was like, oh, yes, ma'am. I said, I'd like to meet with him. I'd like you to set up a meeting with him in a public place. And I'd like to talk with him. And he was like, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. He was very cooperative. And so I went out to the monastery and I actually met with him. And he greeted me warmly. He said, oh, I remember you. And I was like, you do? You know, because this was now 30 years after the fact. And he said, oh, yes, you were just such an affectionate little child. You used to come and run to my office, and I loved it when you'd sit on my lap, and, you know, we'd hug and kiss. And he just was so naive. He was so innocent. I mean, so it was personal. And I, you know, talking to him, I heard some of his story, and he had been one of those, you know, loyal Catholic children whose mother on her deathbed said, "My wish for you is that you become my son, the priest." And a lot of priests come, you know, who, for whatever reason, he was 15 years old and he promised his mother he'd become a priest. So I could see the distortion, you know, in him personally was because he had not, you know, had the wherewithal to have a normal life. You know, he'd made this bargain that haunted him. But as I look back, you know, it was also the system, you know, that allowed him to do that, that there were no safeguards in place at all. I mean, today I think maybe children are, sometimes I see them overprotected from what can happen. And I have to say, you know, as much as that whole incident affected my life, on balance, it's a good thing. You know, I because I have been determined to find the good in it, you know, and that I think is something that I, you know, I just turned 73 on Monday, and I look back on my life and I think, you know, there was something in me when I came into this existence that was just determined to celebrate the life in which I found myself. So not everyone has that, you know, or hasn't connected with their, that positive, that life force. And so that's why I feel really, you know, glad for any opportunity I have. And I do this with, you know, with the artists who come to me who want to, who are stuck in some way, you know, to help empower people to, you know, if you hear that little voice that says, do art, you know, see what happens. You know, so a kind of a curiosity about, well, what could be, rather than, you know, a focus on, oh, this awful thing happened, and so I can't. You know, I think I've always had it sort of in me, not always, but at some point I woke up and I said, you know, I'm in charge here. You know, or the God in me is in charge here. You know, however you want to language it. But something in me has wanted life and to have it abundantly, you know. So I see my life in those terms, and I really invite others. I love inviting others also. And I've, you know, now 20 years later, I'm Facebook friends with some of the people who were, you know, the other women, and I see how they've gone on to live, you know, that there was something powerful in that acknowledgement of that one good priest, you know, and the support of the media who at that time were willing to believe us and to follow our story. But I've seen healing. I've seen these women. You know, one of these women was, had developed a multiple personality. You know, another woman who had never told her husband of, you know, 40 years about what had happened. You know, it's like, oh my goodness. But, you know, daughters and mothers were reconciled, including my own. My mother was 90 when this happened, you know, when the story, when on the ceremony took place. And, you know, so healing did happen. And so I really understand that people can transform their lives. And, you know, that label of survivor is a powerful one. But I'd like to add that, you know, thriving is also an option.
Survivor.
A thriving survivor.
A thriver.
What did you call it? What did you say?
A thriver.
A thriver.
A thriving survivor.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Let me tell you. Pardon me for doing that. As a person that went to Catholic schools, that grew up, there was 9 kids in my family, and I didn't make it through the Catholic schools. I made it to the 10th grade, but it wasn't because of anything like what you went through. But I had several friends who went to the seminary and went on and followed it all the way through to ordination. But as they got into Catholicism, their eyes were opened into the priesthood, their eyes were opened hugely. And then as I moved around, I'll never forget, I knew a priest that I met in the Yukon Territory, a Canadian. And he told me a story about, he went to a seminary in Alberta, Canada. And he told me a story about a culture that thrived within that seminary, that these people were predators that lived in, that were in there. And that he was just disgusted with it. And he, the bishop came and he got up in front of the bishop with all of them and just let him have it for what he saw.
Yeah.
And, but he went on, he became an ordained priest and, you know, he was out there in the bush by himself, but.
Well, you know, and I think that's the thing, individuals can make a difference. You know, if they're willing to kind of see clearly what the situation is and, you know, if they want to spend their life trying to reform it, I tend to think, because I saw in my own experience of starting my own church, because I was like, I wanted to find a church I could breathe in. And Unity churches are quite open. It's a philosophy of empowerment. It's not hung up on dogma and creed. And, you know, they tend to be kind of joyful gatherings of human beings who want something more in their life. But I found myself, even in this creation of my own church, falling into under the archetype of religion, you know, that there would be people who would come and want to project their helplessness or whatever, their feelings of disempowerment onto an authority. And they would want me to be the authority. And so I could just see how this, the whole notion of organizing religion, trying to encapsulate a spiritual quest into a form that's set up for abuse, you know, that I could see myself becoming an abuser. And that's the irony of it all, that when I sat down with the priest to confront him, I was able to do it from the perspective of I am also an ordained person. I understand what the temptations are, and, you know, so I had compassion for him, but I also told him the truth. I said, you know, when you were kissing me with your tongue in my mouth, that was sexual. It wasn't affectionate. And I said, this is, you know, you were wrong. And he, well, this is sort of what I wrote about in the op-ed article at the Atlanta Journal, was he said, as we parted, he said, well, at least I'm not like those priests you read about in the newspaper. I said, oh, really? I said, in what way are you different? He said, well, I never did anything to little boys. You know, and it also speaks to, you know, the sexism, you know, the fact that the church really doesn't recognize women as whole beings. They won't ordain women. But he really was clueless. And he went to his death. I mean, he at the time when in 2002 and 3, when we were actively involved in these negotiations, the good priest, I call him Dennis Stike, you know, he went out to the monastery several times and said, you know, you're dying. Don't you have any remorse for what happened? He said, you know, and he was just in such denial. He said, no, nothing happened. And so that was sad. You know, it was really sad because it was a small community and a lot of the children's parents, you know, the priest finally left when one of the girls, and I learned this much later, one of the girls finally told her father, and her father, they lived across the street from the rectory where the priest lived. And so the father went across the street and told the perpetrator priest, if you're not gone by the morning, I'll kill you. And that's when he finally left. He was transferred to another diocese in Louisiana, where he repeated his abuse with somebody who was able to, I don't know, the church had to respond in some way. There was a lawsuit, but the guy was being moved around and did finally land in this monastery where they believed he would be safe. They thought that they were protecting children from him. But he also said, as part of my interview with him, he says, I don't see many children, but there's this one family that comes and they have a little girl and she's 5 years old. And I love when she comes, she'll climb up on my lap and I just love holding her little bottom in my hands. And so, I was just like, oh my God, So it's human, and I too met priests who had been abused in seminary, who were so tortured, and these were a couple of, this one in particular I became quite close to, who was, wanting to leave or contemplating leaving the priesthood. And he was clearly gay, but he was so unsure of that, and so we actually went out on a date. He asked me to go on, because I was a very safe person for him being another clergy person. And we went out, and he was just such a sweet man. And, I encouraged him to get help. And he did get into therapy and then kind of mysteriously died, in his early 40s. The details of that were never. But, this was stuff that went really deep. But I guess I want to focus on, the joy that came to me of making art and what continues to fuel my life today and can put this stuff, I tell this story because I think there's still people who have suffered abuse of various kinds who, deserve to be heard, who deserve to be believed. But I want to offer, that there's hope that comes with the healing. And for me, the hope is that we can find, as I believe I have found, an outlet, for what's good and true and beautiful in every human being. And that's what I find my art. When I came up to Michigan, I was just entranced with the beauty. And I wanted to have, just be able to paint landscape for the rest of my life. But it's become such a rich, creative place. And my work has become more involved with other issues. I see we're queuing up perhaps this album of music that I was fortunate to commission from a young musician composer in Mexico. Starting over. Yes, beautiful. My work today, I work with artists who are, or people who think they might want to be artists, but they've kind of disqualified themselves because they don't believe they have any talent. And so I tell them, I taught myself to paint simply by continuing to listen to that little voice inside. The paintings I make today are larger. This project that I've worked on for many years since 2018, called Birds Fly In, A Human Refuge, is about using art and music and poetry to, kind of transcend, it's to deal with human migration issues, issues at the border that are so troubling to humans today in our country. But also not just political issues, but just those things that we do to disqualify ourselves, to build borders within our own minds and hearts, our beliefs and our attitudes, our judgments, all of these things that, as a painter, when I just stand in front of a blank canvas and start to paint, these are the things that get in the way. If I'm not in the way, I can paint beauty. So I did want to just mention before we get into this music, which is so beautiful, because Mike, you had brought up my action on the beach front in Frankfurt earlier this year. I just feel these, I've been gifted in my life with, you can call it courage, but I think of it as just an ability to respond when I sense an injustice occurring, or even like a violation of beauty. And when I went, you know, for years I was involved in the process of the conversations, the sort of the one-way conversation about the placement of a bathroom on the Frankfurt Beach. And a moment just came, you know, I think it was in February of last year when stakes went in the ground. And I had just painted this big, beautiful painting called Beautiful of the Earth. And I walked down to the beach and I saw these ugly stakes in the ground that I knew that they were, you know, getting ready to build this permanent structure on the beach. And it so just struck me as no. It was just such a like clear no. This is a beautiful place. People love this. Don't put a permanent structure. And it was like everything just sort of came together within a few hours. You know, somebody had said, you know, you don't have to, you could like create a petition and see how many other people, see if other people are aligned with you. And then it turned out that there were, you know, several thousand people who had not been heard. So I think it's very important to me that our voices be heard. You know, that cancer that was in my mouth, when it was removed, it was like I lost my fear of public speaking because the truth wanted to come through. And it was like that thing in my mouth had been getting in the way. So I'm like, let's get everything out of the way that keeps all of us, any of us, from fully expressing who we are. You know, let us find the flow of life and step into it. And just not hold anything back.
Ellie, this has just been a fascinating conversation to me. And it's been you, not so much a conversation. We have another person that was going to be on at 10 to the hour.
Pardon me for doing that.
So I hate to say this is the end, but I'll tell you, I hope that you will come back because we didn't even get through one-tenth of what I have in my notes to talk about today.
Yeah. I would love that, Mike. Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's hear one of the songs, maybe. They've got number 4 queued up called, what's it called?
It's called Starting Over, and this is a composition by David Mendoza, who's a violinist and composer in San Miguel de Allende. I met him and commissioned this, an album, an hour's worth of music, and it's the soundtrack for Birds Fly In, A Human Refuge.
You're listening to WUWU 100.1 LPFM in Frankfort, Alberta. And this is What's Up With You. And our guest this morning,
Ellie Harold. Ellie, this musician, that was a beautiful, beautiful number, is somebody that you somehow ran across, and this goes along with your exhibit, Birds Fly In.
Yes. Met him in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, where I was doing art retreats with women. I do, here in Frankfurt, I do open studio workshops in the summertime, and I do want to, you know, just invite people. I'm here all winter with a couple of few weeks out for good behavior. But I'm here and welcome people to come visit me at my studio, which is at 402 Forest Avenue in Frankfurt. And people can also check out my artwork at ellieharold.com, ELLIEHAROLD.com.